Case number 08-5508. Eileen Hayes et al. Versus Kathleen Sebelius, Acting Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services et al. Appellants. Ms. Shavitz for the appellants, Mr. Garrison for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. Samantha Heifetz, on behalf of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and the four Medicare administrative contractors. A plaintiff has challenged here a 2008 local coverage determination pertaining to Duoneb. Now, Duoneb is a product that offers two drugs, albuterol and ipratropium, in a single package. And those same two drugs, which are approved for use together to treat plaintiff's condition, are also packaged and sold separately. Indeed, it's the same pharmaceutical company that makes all three products. The agency here determined that the convenience of Duoneb's combination packaging is not medically necessary, doesn't impart any therapeutic benefit, and so would not justify additional reimbursement beyond the level of the two component drugs. That kind of determination reflects the Secretary's longstanding, consistent understanding of the Medicare statutes going back decades.
Why not withdraw coverage altogether if it's as you state?
Well, this is certainly an effort here by Medicare to balance, by the agency, to balance the dual goals of providing as much coverage as possible, facilitating medical care, at the same time.
The statute says no payment may be made if it's not medically necessary.
Well, what the statute refers to specifically is that notwithstanding other provisions,
no payment
for any expenses incurred for items or services. Yeah. So as your honors note, look, this is certainly, it has never been thought that the secretary had to pay for the most elaborate version of a given piece of durable medical equipment. That's where this situation normally arises, is with regard not to drugs, which is a small universe of drugs in Part B, but normally arises with regard to medical equipment where we have many price points, different versions of a hospital bed, some that have features that may be aesthetic or may be for purposes simply that go beyond the medical need of a given patient.
Has anyone raised this kind of challenge with respect to durable medical equipment?
We're not aware of any case involving a challenge based on durable. There are 27.
Is the product we're dealing with a durable medical equipment device?
It is not. It is an inhalation drug, and it falls within a small category. Part A, as your honors are aware, covers in-care hospitalization expenses. Part B of Medicare deals with outpatient services, and it also deals with some other items such as medical equipment used in a person's home, so a need for a hospital bed in one's home. In addition, it covers a small category, a relatively small category of drugs. Most drug coverage is pursuant to Part D.
Right.
Part B drugs tend to be drugs, you know, injectables that are administered in a pharmacy or by a doctor in the physician's office, some cancer drugs that can be taken at home. This particular drug, these drugs, albuterol and ipratropium, are considered a supply for the nebulizer.
So these are not DMEs, the Duoneb.
Duoneb is not a DME. It's an inhalation drug, but it's expressly covered by this part.
So that gets me to my next question. On page A64 of the appendix, which is the manual, CMS manual, which you cite, by the way, as the authority for the independent are these fiscal intermediaries?
The system of carriers and fiscal intermediaries has essentially been replaced by what are referred to as Medicare administrative contractors.
Okay, contractors. So the contractor has to follow this. But what it says here is that As far as LCA, least costly alternative, it says that it shall be applied by contractors when determining payment for all DMEs, durable medical, but contractors have the discretion to apply it to payment for non-DME services. So that means by, from what you said, that the contractors here had discretion to apply this least costly alternative to this Duo-NEB, right?
So there are, to answer your question a few parts, there are a couple of sources that we cite, both the Program Integrity Manual, which provides instructions to the...
says they have discretion.
Absolutely. And the way that that language... the reason that that language is there is for the benefit of the contractors, to provide them with a reassurance, because really this arises, I noted earlier, in the context of durable medical equipment. And it's quite apparent why that's the case. That is an area where we have many instances of a given item, whether it's a wheelchair or a hospital bed, where multiple versions will be made.
I just want to cut to the chase here, because...
The discretion...
This whole discussion raises a question that I don't really see addressed here. But if the contractor is not just playing ventriloquist dummy, that if the contractor has discretion, as this manual seems to say, and the contractor fastens upon, as here, an interpretation of the statute, why is it that a Article III federal court ought to be deferring to Cigna or whoever it is that's the private contracting agency that you've given discretion to? Why do we owe them any deference whatsoever?
Well, the policy is not only embodied here in the Program Integrity Manual, but the least costly alternative principle, as it's referred to, is also in the Medicare benefits policy. And so that's why, Your Honor, I started to note that this is
and
not the only place it shows.
Question, I'm not hearing an answer.
Yes.
To follow up my question, CMS, which is the agency, did in fact consider making a nationwide decision with respect to this least costly alternative on this particular item, the Duo-NEB, and decided not to, right?
There has not been any national coverage determination with regard to Duo-NEB.
But I know there hasn't been, but they studied it, and they decided they weren't going to do it.
There has been discussion of other related national coverage determinations, but I don't believe there has been one specific to Duo-NEB.
Go ahead.
Well, to address the question with regard to discretion, the reason that language is here is a recognition that this type of situation in which there are two drugs, this is a unique case we have here with two drugs available packaged separately and then also available packaged conveniently together, you can make a real head-to-head comparison, as the agency has done, and say that they're equivalent. And, of course, that factual determination is not before this court. Administrative exhaustion would be required to pursue that, and that hasn't been done here. But because it is a rare instance in which things other than durable medical equipment are amenable to this kind of comparison, the term discretion appears here to make clear to the contractors that they will not be penalized if they fail to recognize in a given instance that there are drugs that are equivalent in this way, because it's a significant undertaking. The local coverage determination requires significant evidence be put forward and considered by the local administrator. And so there's concern on the contractor's part that they would be required to scan all of the available therapeutics. Your Honor, sorry, I apologize.
You argue that the Secretary's authority to do this comes from 1395, right? And from, under your theory, the fact that that this is an expense that is not reasonable or necessary, right? That reasonable or necessary modifies expense.
Right. The local coverage determination was made pursuant to 1395 YA1.
Right.
That is correct.
Okay. But what do you do with the fact that the statute, that section is called items or services specifically excluded? It doesn't say expenses.
The statutory language does include the phrase expenses incurred services.
Would you agree that the Secretary can't prevail here if reasonable and necessary modifies items or services, right?
That would certainly be a more difficult case, and that's not the case we have here. We have the term expenses incurred for.
But for you, we have to read reasonable necessaries modifying expenses. And my question is, it's the section is not entitled expenses excluded. It's entitled items or services specifically excluded, and 1A follows the phrase items or services, not expenses. So I just don't see how you can read the statute the way you are.
The idea that the statute bars the secretaries, it has never, as Your Honors noted earlier, it has never been the understanding of secretary
stick with the statute.
Well, absolutely.
You claim your authority comes from this statute and this reading of the statute, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and so I can't read it the way you are. Explain to me how I can read it that way.
I think that what the district court did here was come to the conclusion that the reading of Your Honor was the most natural
that's not the right standard. But suppose I'm looking at it and I'm saying to you, this is the only reading I see in the statute. That is the Chevron 1 question, right?
Well, to say that it's the only reading would be to read as mere surplusage the reference to expenses incurred for, and would also be to ignore the notwithstanding any other provision language.
Well, it wouldn't eliminate that at all.
Well, I think it is the expenses incurred for it leaves space here for this court to determine that what the secretary has done is reasonable.
Okay, but you
and
agree,
the
you
contrary result.
Think, yeah. What?
Well, as Your Honors began to note earlier,
the secretary hasn't done anything, has it? I thought this was a contractor's.
These are contractors who are agents of the secretary. So a local coverage determination.
Can I ask? I want to follow up on Judge Tatel's question on interpreting this statute. You're only, and we're only focusing on subsection 1 of this 1395Y, right? But there are 26 other subsections, right? Correct?
That is correct.
And so I want to plug your interpretation in of the preliminary clause to some of these other subsections. And when I do that, I wind up with absurdities, because you're saying no payment may be made, and you're stressing for any expenses, right?
Well, incurred for items or services that are reasonable and necessary.
Which are required, look at number 5, which are required as a result of war. So under your interpretation, you can't get payment for tanks or missiles or anything else under Medicare. Why would Congress have put that in there? That's bizarre. That's, makes no sense.
Did you say tanks? I just didn't hear you.
Look at subsection 5.
Right.
Yeah. No, you can't get payment for expenses under Medicare which are required as a result of war. Services and items and whatever. How does that make any sense?
Well, even under the reading that Judge Tatel has put forward, that provision stands for the proposition that expenses incurred for items or services which are required as a result of war occurring after the effective date under such part, et cetera. So I'm not sure that the result is any different whether or not you read it to modify expenses incurred for or the items or services.
It tells us that what this statute's about is items and services, not expenses.
Look, Your Honor, there's no question that in the normal case we are often talking about items or services holistically.
We're asking you about this because this is where you claim the secretary gets her authority to do this.
Well, actually,
for the secretary to have this authority, reasonable and necessary must modify expenses. That's why we're pursuing this with you. And,
absolutely.
And none, at least two of us can't see how that works. I mean, it also says, are not reasonable and necessary for the diagnosis or treatment of illness or injury. That makes sense if you're talking about items and services, but that's not the way you'd speak if you were talking about expenses.
It also makes sense, however, if you're speaking about expenses, because here what we have, if we take Duoneb, are two drugs, albuterol and ipratropium. Clearly, those two drugs are considered medically necessary and appropriate for the treatment of plaintiff's condition. However, in the when we put them together in Duoneb, what we have are, again, two drugs that are appropriate, but an additional service that is incurring an additional cost that is not shown, that the agency's contractors have shown is not medically necessary.
This must come up under Part D all the time, this question, doesn't it?
No, 1395, Your Honor, applies to Part A and Part B.
The question that you're discussing, I see advertisements for drugs that you can take one pill for both high blood pressure and cholesterol, right? But I don't know whether that's more expensive than two separate pills for the same, you know, same thing. I just wonder whether it might come up all the time.
Here's what you think the statute means, right? You think we should read it this way. Notwithstanding any other provision, no payment may be made for any expenses which are incurred for items and services that are unreasonable and unnecessary, right? That's what you think this means.
That is correct. But
it doesn't say that.
Well,
I can rewrite the statute to say exactly what you want.
I don't think that would be necessary, Your Honor, because the statute, by
not reasonable or necessary,
to for any expenses
be helpful
incurred for items or services leaves room. And as I noted earlier, and as Your Honor's noted, what's at stake here is the effect of plaintiff's argument, of the district court's holding, is that the secretary reimburses for the most basic hospital bed that can possibly satisfy the patient's needs.
Yeah.
Or doesn't reimburse at all, doesn't reimburse for the patient who elects a model with additional features, extra bells and whistles,
that's
whether
a
it's a pulse monitor.
Congress made the choice that if something's going to be covered,
As this court has noted consistently, we have a tremendously complex statute here that is where there is much discretion.
Excuse me, this statute doesn't look that, this language, I agree with you, this statute's complex. But the question before us is this language clear? That's all we have to ask.
And I think the one thing that's...
And if it produces consequences of the kind you're talking about, it sounds like it does, then Congress needs to fix it. We don't really have that authority.
Well, it seems far-reaching to say that there is no way to read any expenses incurred for items or services as providing for this, when what we have here is clearly products, in this particular case with Duoneb and albuterol and ipratropium
Keep going back to this particular case, but your reading of this will apply far beyond this particular situation, right?
It absolutely applies
CMS say we think it's appropriate to say, as a cost-saving measure, to say you can only recover 75% of the market price for this particular drug?
The secretary has never taken that position. The court is not being asked to write the agency check. Because
under your theory, that would seem permissible.
Well, the agency has presented a consistent view, and if we turn to the formal statutes in the CFR, for example, 400.202, we are not suggesting that that local coverage determinations can be used to simply set payment rates arbitrarily or based on some assessment of market value. That's the regs prohibit that. That's not what's happening here. We're talking about a consistent view of what the agency should do with a limited universe of products where we have clinical equivalence in meeting a patient's medical needs, where that's shown.
What about the fact that Congress in 2003 seemed to make a clear policy determination that it didn't want the government setting prices for drugs?
Though there is a formula here that is being employed, this is not a situation in which we are setting prices for drugs. It is, as I say, an instance where we have this kind of unique clinical
equivalent. Congress wanted it to be set at 106% of market price, right?
And that is ultimately... there's no deviation from that, as I noted. It's not simply as if, as Your Honor suggested, might be the case, the Secretary is coming in and suggesting that there ought to be some arbitrary or some percentage discount. What we have here is an attempt to balance the agency's fiscal responsibilities that the courts have observed in TAP and Lirum and Bodum with this desire to provide for adequate patient choice as opposed to the absurd result, as Your Honor noted.
Is there anything in the provisions where the secretary determines the amount of reimbursement? What is that, K or what? I forget.
That's
what
part of, yes.
Is there anything in there that where the secretary could take a look at a combination device like we have here and say, it's too expensive, and in the exercise of my discretion, I will cut your payment back to 75% of market cost, for example?
We don't have that obviously would be a very different determination. That would be a determination about payment as opposed to what we have here, which is an exercise of the coverage determination.
That's not an answer. I know it's different, let me tell you why I'm asking the question. The reason I'm asking the question is that one of the premises, it seems to me, of your argument from a policy standpoint is that if you disagree with this contractor's interpretation here, then all these really expensive devices and things are going to, there's no way that we're going to wind up having to pay all this money for these expensive devices. So I'm asking you the question.
We as patients as opposed to as.
No, we as taxpayers.
Well, the agency, I mean, I think our position, the understanding is that, you know, 1395YA1 continues to apply. The reasonable necessary threshold question cannot be bypassed. So in a world without this principle, it is not simply the case that a plaintiff would be reimbursed fully necessarily for her, fancy hospital bed or whatnot. There would be no coverage.
In all these reimbursement determinations and so on and so forth, is there a way to reach, for you to reach this, for the secretary to reach basically the same result that the contractor reached?
The plaintiff points to provisions in Part A with regard to reasonable cost and reasonable charge in Part B that are not applicable here. The Part B provisions don't apply to the drug at issue here or durable medical equipment and are largely outmoded provisions that were in place in effect in the 1980s and 1990. The only provision that would come anywhere close to what Your Honor is contemplating is a provision that's not discussed in the briefs that deals with inherent reasonableness. But that provision, which perhaps Your Honor is thinking of, addresses a completely distinct issue, which is whether or not once you have determined that an item or service and the expenses associated with it should be covered, whether the amount, after applying the statutory formula that Congress has set forth or the fee schedule that has been laid out, whether that amount is still grossly deficient or grossly excessive. It's a very different question being asked there. It's not about a head-to-head comparison of products where we're concerned with the kind of consumer choice and limitations that are at issue here.
It's the grossly? Are you talking about 1395U?
Yes. And that provision deals with locality adjustments. It deals with a single product.
Nobody cited that, have you?
No, that's correct. But that's that provision, which is the only thing that comes anywhere, I thought perhaps was what Your Honor had in mind, that provision really is very distinct. It deals with excess charges being made to Medicare as opposed to non-Medicare providers. It deals with concerns about competition in the marketplace.
So time has expired, and I just have one more question for you. That section that you just mentioned that I had looked at, in fact, it talks about the grossly. It has to be grossly.
Correct.
But there's another provision that I think the parties cite, or maybe you do. It's on 131 to 132 of the joint appendix, and it deals with reasonableness of the equipment. And one of the tests is whether the item is substantially more costly than a medically appropriate and realistically feasible alternative. So,
well, this is what Your Honor is referring to is part of the benefits manual that is addressing the policy at issue here.
Okay, yeah, but let me just follow through. You gave us, was it your footnote? I think it was your footnote 5 that said that the difference between the cost as of April 2009 was that the two items purchased separately was 22 cents a dose, and if you get the Duo-Neb, it's now 24 cents. Is a 2-cent difference
to update?
Is a 2-cent difference substantially more costly?
The determination here, there are a number of questions that are laid out in the manual as relevant to the determination of reasonableness, as well as issues related to necessity. The determination here was that providing a patient with combination packaging of ipratropium and albuterol was not medically necessary, that it served
because there were cheaper alternatives.
Exactly.
Well, it's because there was another product that provides the same.
Expensive.
That is certainly a point.
Well, that's not a point. That's the reason they did it.
But was it substantially more expensive?
Well, that's the substantially more costly is another element of a reasonableness determination. But there are other. That's not the only question that is presented.
What about that question?
Well, I would note for Your Honor that in fact that question has the issue of the cost differential has moved further. Since the briefing occurred in the case, the cost of the two items has converged, and so they are essentially the same price. That may well be the that was not the case at the time of briefing, and that may be the conclusion that Your Honor's reached. The price of the two drugs is now the same.
I tried to check that, but the website, I couldn't.
I believe it's been since July 2000, this past July 2009, and it continued into October presently. They are being, they have been fully reimbursed throughout because of the injunction that was entered by the district court. So at no point has this policy gone into effect.
Why isn't the case moot?
That would be a fair conclusion at this time.
They've been being reimbursed, right?
Everyone has been reimbursed fully.
Wouldn't the department, if the department succeeds here, wouldn't you, I take it they would owe you money for the period of time when the prices diverged?
My understanding is that the secretary would not take that. I cannot speak for the secretary officially on that question, so I do not know, but I don't think that that.
Then it's not moot.
It's not moot, right.
If Your Honors would be of interest in that question, the answer to that question, we would be happy to provide a formal.
We will let you know if we want to know that. Thank you.
May it please the court. Let me clarify or correct two matters before I talk in more general terms. First, this is not an item of durable medical equipment. It's a combination drug. Moreover, it's not two drugs, it's one. It has a single HCPCS code that applies to it, so that the exercise that the Secretary has attempted to perform is exactly the one Judge Tatel mentions. Judge Randolph, in answer to your question about what it is that Congress has empowered the Secretary to do in the case of an unduly expensive drug, may I invite your attention to Section 1395, small w, 3AD of the statute, which has a regime that charges the Secretary with dealing with something called WAMP, widely available market prices. This statute, of course, is all full of acronyms and very long titles to the provisions, lots of letters and numbers. But in short, it empowers the Secretary to conduct a review of this widely available market price and compare it to the ASP, the average sales price, and if it diverges by the amount described, the Secretary is empowered to take action. There is a curative provision that Congress has anticipated.
Of what relevance, if any, is the Secretary's longstanding policy here with respect to durable medical equipment, and so that's point one. And then two, how do you distinguish the durable medical equipment, or maybe you don't and say this will now apply to that as well?
Well, I don't have to, but I could. I mean, let's begin with that. First, this is not a case of durable medical equipment. As to the Secretary's longstanding interpretation, I guess a lot depends on what you mean by longstanding, but the statute that we're dealing with here was enacted in 2003. It has been read by this court, by the Supreme Court, indeed by every court, as doing exactly what Judge Tatel described, as having exactly that meaning, that it's read naturally as no payment may be made under Part A or Part B for any expenses incurred for items and services which are not reasonable and necessary. In Heckler against Ringer, the Chief Justice wrote that opinion. Chief Justice Rehnquist described it exactly the same way. Judge Garland in this court, in the Shalala case, United Senior, Seniors against Shalala read it the same way. Every court did. Indeed, the dog keeps barking. I mean, not only is that the reading of the statute, the logical reading of the statute, especially as Judge Tatel pointed out, given its title, but then we go on, the mechanism chosen here is the LCD. What is that? That local coverage determination. The secretary herself, or predecessor of the current secretary, promulgated 42 CFR 400.202, which describes, consistent with the statute itself, that a local coverage determination means a decision by a fiscal intermediary or carrier whether to cover a particular service. An LCD does not include a determination of which procedure code, if any, is assigned to a service or a determination with respect to the amount of payment to be made for that service.
Let me go back to the statute for a minute.
Yes, sir.
The department, they rely on the phrase, notwithstanding any other provision of this subchapter. They think that that somehow means that the phrase modifies expenses. Do you understand that?
I mean, again, I don't see what subchapter, notwithstanding, would help the government with in this case.
If you succeed here, if you're right, what happens to reimbursement for doing that?
It would continue. Well, ASP keeps changing, of course, and that is certified. But it would
The department has said that it's not DUNAB is not reasonable and necessary. So doesn't that mean it would be no reimbursement?
Yes, it would.
So if you win, your drug gets no reimbursement.
No, the department hasn't made that determination.
They've already said it's not necessary.
If they did, we'd be here in a different case, challenging as arbitrary and capricious.
No, your argument is the reason they've said it's not just in reasonable and necessary is because it's too expensive, and that's what's wrong.
That's what they've done. Yeah. And indeed, throughout this litigation, they've taken the position that
But I'm right that there's no, this is a, it's an either or with this statute.
That's
right?
Correct.
If it's necessary and appropriate, it has to be at 106%. If it's not necessary and appropriate, no reimbursement.
That's right.
I'm still confused. You say they have taken this position throughout the litigation and so on and so forth. But this is a private contractor's decision.
Let's talk specifically about that. And I also want to mention why, both for the reason earlier stated and for another reason, the case isn't moot. But I certainly get what you're talking about. That so-called discretion comes from a program manual. It's not anything that has the force of law. Our position, of course, is that there is a statute and there is a regulation that supervene anything that's in that coverage. But Your Honor makes, at least hypothetically, a significant separation of powers argument, that there's something that has been delegated to an entity that is outside of the government and for decision-making, and it's entitled to no deference.
If they're rendering decisions that require us to defer to them and thousands, millions of people are affected by them, why aren't they doesn't that violate the appointments clause?
That's a fair point. What happened in this case is that they were Charlie McCarthy to the Secretary's Edgar Bergen.
How is it that all four of the regional carriers suddenly came up with the same result?
They were told to.
Is there an order to that effect in the record?
Yes.
Where is that?
Do you have the exact page? I'll get it for Your Honor. While he's doing that, let me just mention that the case is not moot because of the issue that Judge Kavanaugh described.
What do you think about the amicus's position? So can cost be taken into account in making, or do you not take a position on it, making the initial coverage determination?
Let me say one thing before I get to that. We don't need to take that position, which is why we didn't. It's probably slightly too generous a statement, though it's entirely accurate with respect to everything that's at issue here. You'll note in the statute that the secretary has a couple levers for dealing with cost under emergency conditions that have no applicability here, and also under the WAMP analysis that I described a little bit earlier. So that there are a few areas where Congress has said that the secretary can deal directly with cost. The one most applicable to this is if it conducts a survey and finds that disparity.
If you win here, one other question just to follow up on the durable medical equipment. I don't see any way that we would write an opinion that wouldn't apply logically, even if we tried to just say we're not answering the question, that wouldn't apply logically to durable medical equipment as well.
I agree.
Okay, so
that
goes with this.
I mean, we claim that the Secretary simply lacks the authority to make this an economic judgment that's unrelated to medical treatment with regard to this drug. It's just the position here, which has never been countenanced by any court. The provision has never been read this way by any court. Works to our favor.
If there's ambiguity in the statute, and there may not be, of course, but to the extent there is ambiguity in the statute, it is odd to say that for a client such as yourself, well, the choice is no coverage or coverage at the full price, because that may, in many cases, mean no coverage.
Well, the reason why I can say it with I hope not false confidence, but with some assuredness, is that we have an approved use for the combination product. We have a HCPCS number for the billing of the product. There's a great deal that...
Just to take it out broadly to other items, there may be things that are helpful to people, but they're just... And the government might choose to cover it up to a certain amount, but not above the other, but it's going to be forced to say no coverage at all.
Let me say two things about that. First...
Aren't there other provisions that... Council was discussing with Judge Randolph that give them the authority to reduce the price?
There might be, but not
on
in
this.
Any way that's relevant here.
Oh. Yeah.
To answer your question, this is a matter of common discussion. This provision of the statute is written and rewritten on a decade basis. One of those decades is now. And you could take, if you wish, judicial notice of the fact that this whole concept is being debated as part of this administration's health care initiative, and indeed...
Where would that take us if we did that?
I'm sorry, sir?
What would be the implications of us doing that?
There would be no implication of it at all, just to recognize that this is a matter that's in play. I'm speaking to the hypothetical future that Judge Kavanaugh...
I think you're suggesting we shouldn't worry about the policy. We should just interpret the statute.
That's correct. Yeah. You're being asked to perform a legislative act here, and
Do you want to finish what you were about to say about mootness?
The variable, I'm not sure you can find it in the record, although it is in the administrative record. The independent variable affecting the cost of Duaneb is the price of the vial.
Oh.
The supply is shorter than the demand in the large universe, and hence the price of the product fluctuates, so that at various times the condition that we see where Duaneb might be the same price as the two individual components separately isn't always the case.
I mean, it might not be that way next week.
That's correct. That's the answer to that.
I did. You mentioned, I think you just cited a regulation, but these contractors are not permitted to make payment determinations. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
All right. And then the decisions that came down, I guess there are four of them, and they're all exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
But the contractor denies that they've taken into account the cost of an item.
Well,
they say in response to a claim that they were precluded from using cost as a basis for a determination, they say a cost of an item does not enter into a benefit category determination or into the overall determination of medical necessity.
How can that be so?
The cost is everything. That's why they're making this determination.
Of course it is.
So if they're precluded by the regulation from making cost determinations, isn't that – do we really have to get into the interpretation of the statute or anything else?
I don't think there's anything to interpret. I think the statute is clear on its face. And that the secretary or anybody who has anything delegated from the secretary lacks the authority to do this.
You were going to give me the place where the...
There was a memo, the final decision memo, I believe, is that of September 10th, 2007. Look at page A228 of the joint appendix.
I've got that. What does that say?
There's a section that talks about background information.
It says CMS released a proposed decision memo. Is that what you're talking about?
This happened at the same time.
But the final, I referred to this when the Secretary was arguing that CMS never issued a national coverage.
Yeah, they told the four contractors, you go do this, and they all did.
Well, consider it. They didn't tell them exactly what to do.
I think it was said, I mean, I'm not a mind reader, but I think it's logical to presume that they took that as a statement
well,
that was pregnant
that
with meaning.
I've tried to read that national coverage decision memo. I mean, it's pretty dense, but I didn't find any directive in there. So.
Now, we're not going to complain if Your Honor was going to conclude that this was an improper delegation. However,
there's a question of Chevron deference.
And
who are we deferring to? We are not deferring to the Secretary because we don't have a Secretary determination here. The only body that we have left to defer to is a private contractor. And I don't know of any case where the federal court has ever done that.
Our point is slightly different from that, though it includes it, which is there's nobody to defer to here. That this is a position that's made up for this case. It's different from what the Secretary
I thought your position was, regardless of this whole thing, the statute's clear. We would never get to the question.
I don't disagree with
that
at all.
Isn't that your point?
If I were to assume that someone were interested in taking this to step two of Chevron, I would then argue that there's nobody to whom to defer. Just looking at the LCD regulation itself. Answers the question. If there's nothing further, I submit. Thank you.
Okay.
When you said that LCD regulation, you mean that 400.0?
Yes,
yeah, okay.
Correct.
So, Ms. Chaffetz, you're out of time, right? Isn't she? No more time?
Yes.
Yeah. Way out of time. You can take 2 minutes if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is not a determination that was about the expenses. To be clear, what the local coverage determinations found was that there was no medical necessity associated with providing patients with ipratropium and albuterol in a single vial as opposed to in two vials.
That's because there were two cheaper alternatives.
The not covering it is certainly one possibility here, and really that's the outcome. The outcomes that we have before us are either the Secretary has to pay in the durable medical equipment world, where we do have a more complicated set of concerns in terms of variation and consumer choice,
right, there might be
pay the most.
Why wasn't it medically necessary?
Because there's no benefit associated with it. And let me turn to that point for a moment. If the plaintiff had wanted to challenge... That's correct. And that is a fact determination that is not before this court. There is an administrative exhaustion process laid out clearly in the statute and in the regulations. And if plaintiff had wanted to seek review on that question, wanted to show that there was medical necessity, then she could have pursued that.
I just want to stop you because I see a problem with that argument. It's a very clever argument. But if we had the separate drugs before us, right? You could say the same thing. There's no medical necessity to have separate drugs because we already have the product.
Well, I don't think that's a problem. I think that actually underscores precisely what we have here, which is clinical equivalence.
The difference is the cost. The difference is the cost, and that's what drives it, right?
The cost may be a difference. That may be a fact, as we noted earlier. But that's not what's driving it because cost could be the same, completely different, marginally different, substantially different. If we didn't have two products that are indeed clinically equivalent, then we wouldn't have a case here today. Is what this turns on, that has not been questioned.
Wasn't this decision made under the least cost alternative policy?
That is the name that is associated with the policy in the benefits manual. Yeah. But it was a local coverage determination that was made, and there is provisions
telling me that this decision was not based on cost?
It was based on the medical necessity determination.
Was it based, did that rest on cost?
No, that was based, there are studies, there's a lengthy administrative record that was studies about patients and different outcomes. There is a significant administrative record that's not before this court because plaintiff hasn't challenged.
If you have two products that, as you say, are clinically identical, does that mean one of those products is not necessary? Or does it mean both of them are necessary, or does it mean neither one of them is necessary?
What we know here is that albuterol and ipratropium, the drugs themselves, are necessary to treat COPD plaintiff's condition. Right. What's not necessary is the physical combination of them in a single vial as Duoneb.
I get back to my question.
Or, sure. I mean,
Hang on. Here's my question. My question is, isn't it just as logical to say, I ask again, isn't it just as logical to say that having the two drugs separately is not medically necessary because we have them in a combination product?
Assuming that neither single nor joint packaging adds or detracts medical value, and that was the decision that was made here, and that's the decision that's not on appeal before this panel, then whatever premium the market might attach, whether that reflects, whatever it reflects, right, whatever it might attach, whether it's to joint packaging or single packaging, it doesn't reflect something of medical value. And for that reason, there's no reason for the agency to be paying, because what this statute, what this large scheme that the secretary has been charged with implementing is about is, as courts have noted in the cases that we cite in our briefs, such as TAP and Lyrum and Bowden, the point is to try to facilitate access.
What if the combination drug, after a while, because of the economics of production, turns out to be cheaper than the two drugs separately?
Well, I think that is precisely, obviously that's not the case that we have at the moment, but that is precisely.
What if that happens? Are then the two drugs separately not medically necessary?
As I noted, it's about whether or not there is medical value.
Yes or no.
These are interchangeable scenarios, because we have neither single nor joint marketing adding or detracting medical value. And the agency here is concerned with covering expenses that are incurred for things that provide patients with medical value, with that which addresses their medical needs.
Your position seems to assume that Congress couldn't possibly have wanted an all or nothing scenario. But why is that so absurd to think that?
You know, if it has never been the understanding of the secretary or the courts that the secretary must pay and reimburse at the greatest end. So that it's not all or nothing. It creates a nothing scenario. And Congress hasn't.
Right. There's an interesting question whether the long-term benefit of the opposing position will be helpful or harmful to patients, right? Because there may be just less coverage. But
right. I mean, there's
Congress,
the standing matter.
I think, made a decision that if it's going to be coverage, we don't want people getting nickel and dimed. We want coverage of the full cost, or the market average, in this case,
well,
of the 106% of the market price.
What we're talking about here, what the secretary has identified in its expertise with regard to durable medical equipment, and then with regard to a very limited group of drugs, is situations where it would be unreasonable to think that Congress envisioned a scheme where it was truly all or nothing, that you could only reimburse for the most basic hospital bed that suits someone's needs for use in their home, or the most basic wheelchair, the most basic cane, the most basic glucose monitor. So, you know, this policy, plaintiff would characterize it as arbitrary, but in fact it's reflective of a reasoned decision-making and expertise that in the benefits policy manual the agency is honing in on an area where that kind of all-or-nothing approach really does produce absurd results. And, you know, just to make very clear, there, to the extent that there are factual determinations or concerns that this court has about the equivalence question, that truly is not presented here. Were that an issue, then it would have been required that the administrative remedies be exhausted.
One final question before you sit down, or if my colleagues have further questions. Did the secretary order these four carriers to reach this result?
No, Your Honor. What happened here is that there had been, for much time, controversy with regard to inhalation drugs. And there's actually discussion in the Medicare Modernization Act legislative history, Congress discussing concerns about inhalation drug reimbursement. And so this had been an issue. You know, the reasonable and necessary provision, 1395YA, of course, always applies as a threshold requirement for coverage. So it's usually done on a case-by-case basis. So there had been concerns about these reimbursements percolating, coming up in the by the local Medicare administrators in making case-by-case determinations. And it was obviously brought to the agency's attention, and so attention was focused on the issue, and the local coverage determinations were then, it was encouraged that the administrators consider the issue, but they were not told what outcome to reach. They then, and this is again in the administrative record that's not before the court, had to gather substantial evidence. There was a period of notice and comment, or comment rather.
Which one of these carriers, we don't have all four of these decisions before us. We technically only have one, even though they're all the same.
Well, all four administrators are here as defendants.
But how can that be? We only have one individual plaintiff.
Because of the nature of the challenge, seeking to enjoin the determinations, all four Medicare administrative contractors were named.
It's only the carrier within her region that should be before us.
Well, she was not, there was no adjudication with regard to her particular claim. She was seeking injunction of these provisions across the board.
Person in San Francisco doesn't have standing to challenge the carrier's decision for the Northeast, period.
That may well be the case. I don't believe that that was addressed below, and I don't believe it's addressed in the briefs. I would have to refer back to the specific direct review provision that applies to local coverage determinations to assess whether or not there is a basis on which these administrative contractors were all brought in this instance.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted.
I thought each judge had a arrest warrant. I think only one. You didn't accidentally hit that alarm, did you?
No.
Okay. Let's see if there's one down there.
No.
I don't think there's one down here. I think that was y'all home down here.
What are you looking for?
There's a little alarm going to be taken for something happened. We're sitting all of us going around.
Oh. Nope. Someone pressed it?
Two of them. People that don't have one.
Yeah.
You're on your own there, huh? I think only the judge here has one.